This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You saw how Museveni's votes were inflated. You saw how the entire electoral process turned into a war situation, a situation of terror.
That was Medard Lubega Sesegona, one of the lawyers for Uganda's opposition presidential candidate Bobi Wine, who is challenging Yoweri Museveni's re-election victory. Details coming up also. Malawi confirms it has cases of the new strain of coronavirus, first found in South Africa. And the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council says millions are suffering in Ethiopia's Tigray region. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. South Africa's first consignment of COVID-19 vaccine is scheduled to touch down at O.R. Tambo International Airport near Johannesburg today. The 1 million AstraZeneca shots have been produced by the Serum Institute of India and will be given to frontline health workers. But as Darren Taylor reports, there are doubts about whether the authorities will be able to keep the vaccines safe from crime.
Both the Serum Institute and South Africa's health department have told VOA the first doses won't carry markings important for their security.
The first batch of product coming in is not going to have barcodes on it. We know that already.
Rob Buerta is a logistics expert who's coordinating South Africa's vaccine rollout.
But further down the line, we do expect that the products coming in as COVID-19 vaccines will have these barcodes.
Security specialists say the absence of barcodes means it's easier for criminals to steal the vaccines. Buerta insists the jabs will be safe from the moment they arrive until they're put into the arms of health sector employees.
Even if it doesn't have a barcode on it, we will still be tracking it using the batch and the expiry date of the product. You'll be able to link the product directly to the patient.
But pharmacologist and medicines advisor to the World Health Organization, Andy Gray, says relying on batch and expiry numbers to safeguard vaccines isn't ideal.
We've got a batch number. That batch number is printed. Sometimes it's imprinted, so it's sort of quashed into the cut into the cardboard. Both of those technologies are very easy to falsify. Those who are making falsified goods will put a batch number on it, and they might even go and find a legitimate one so the batch number is in that series.
According to the WHO and World Customs Union, the best medicine security network has been developed by an international supply chain management firm called GS1. It relies on barcodes called data matrices and allows vaccines to be tracked and traced globally. A scan of the barcode by someone with access to the GS1 system will link to an international database containing a wealth of information about medicines. The system will wave red flags if there's been a problem elsewhere in the world with a particular medicine. Buerta says although the government hasn't bought into the GS1 program, some vaccination sites will still be able to scan the data matrix barcodes, even if it's just for verification and recording purposes.
The big trick is further down the line is, are the systems that are at the lowest level capable of using or identifying the product by the barcode?
Not all, says Gray, because not all are computerized. Buerta says no matter what system's used, criminals are going to try to infiltrate it because of the massive profits they stand to make from one of the world's most sought-after commodities.
The thing is, anything's open to abuse, unless you can really lock it down entirely. The best solution for track and traceability is using serial numbers with an overarching system.
Gray doesn't expect falsified vaccines to be a big issue in South Africa, although there was a consignment of fake vaccines traced to a warehouse near Johannesburg in November already. But Gray does expect criminals to try to steal vaccines.
There, I think we are far more vulnerable than we even know. Theft in public sector facilities is rife. We've certainly had theft from the provincial depots, and we have a lot of theft happening from hospitals. In fact, we've had problems with theft on demand, where people just phone in an order to a member of staff and a box gets packed up for them.
Gray says now that vaccines are finally flowing into the African nation hardest hit by the pandemic, he'd hate for the immunization program to be disrupted by criminals. To prevent that, he says there has to be excellent cooperation between the state, law enforcement, medicine regulators, and the public. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Malawi has confirmed it has cases of the more contagious new strain of the coronavirus that was first found in South Africa, known as 501V2. President Lazarus Chakwera made the announcement last night in a nationally televised address. Chakwera said this means that Malawi must stay in course in preventing the spread of the new strain, which has so far tripled the number of COVID-19 confirmed cases and deaths for the past few weeks. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Chakwera said people should not lose hope, explaining that his administration has secured doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to give immunity to as many citizens as possible.
The first consignment of the vaccine will arrive at the end of February, in readiness for rollout in March, starting with 20% of the population, which will prioritize frontline workers, the elderly, and those with underlying conditions.
Malawi has been suffering a second wave of the pandemic since November. Health authorities put the current average number of daily infections at 300 cases, compared with 10 during the first wave of the pandemic. Chakwera also said the number of people dying from the disease is alarming.
This past week alone, we lost 161 people to COVID-19, including our very own Mte Wambari Mkandawire this morning, who was not only a dear friend and devoted supporter of our cause of national transformation, but was Malawi's greatest music icon.
However, many people oppose taking the vaccine due to myths that doing so would endanger their lives. Chakwera said before the rollout, Malawi scientists will double-check the vaccine.
Our own scientists in our own labs will verify the safety of the vaccine and will give you full information so that no one is misled by social media lies and propaganda against vaccinations that the scientific community has worked hard to provide to save lives.
However, medical expert Dr. John Puka believes many Malawians will use the vaccine despite the rumors.
We have many other examples of vaccines, and Malawi is known for doing very well. Usually our vaccine acceptability is within 80 to 95%. Usually we need about 60 to 80% of a population to be vaccinated. This we call it a herd immunity.
In the meantime, the Minister of Civic Education says it has allocated about $130,000 for national public awareness campaigns on the vaccine. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Death toll from the attack on Mogadishu Hotel rises to 15. Some officials say the death toll has risen to at least 11, with 20 other people injured in an attack yesterday by the Islamist Al-Shabaab group on a popular hotel in the capital, Mogadishu. VOA Somali Service said four assailants also were killed by security forces who were able to rescue dozens of people during the siege that lasted 7 hours. TV footage that circulated on social media showed hotel residents jumping from windows to escape the attack. The attack on the Afrique Hotel, which is known to be heavily guarded, gathering place for government officials and people from the diaspora, began with a car bomb. Then Al-Shabaab gunmen in Somalia military uniforms stormed the building. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack, which came just weeks after U.S. military officials said they have completed the withdrawal of some 700 U.S. troops who had been supporting local security forces. There have been nearly daily protests since mid-January in Tunisia, set off by the anniversary of the revolution that sparked the Arab Spring uprising across the region in 2011. Hundreds of Tunisians marched in the capital to protest police abuses they say are endangering freedoms won in the revolution that swept away authoritarian rule. Meanwhile, Tunisia may encounter a constitutional crisis after the Prime Minister's cabinet reshuffle. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the situation in Tunisia with Mongi Daoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst.
Tunisia is celebrating the 10th anniversary of the revolution. So 10 years ago, the Ben Ali regime fell because of people across Tunisia in almost all the cities and the capital of Tunis came out and expressed their anger, frustration, that they had enough with the old regime and that the miserable condition that they found themselves in, rising unemployment, especially the young people cannot see a future in Tunisia anymore. And they brought down the old regime. And so 10 years later, they look back, many of the same segment of these young Tunisians. Things didn't change. Their situation is very miserable, especially in a lot of the marginalized cities in the south, the interior of the country, in many of the suburbs of Tunisia, of the capital Tunis itself. And so they came out in numbers at night. Most of these protests were organized by young Tunisians. Some of them even did not or cannot remember the Ben Ali era. But what they do see is that there is a revolution that happened, there's a change, but their condition, their family condition, their neighborhoods, their cities have not seen any improvement at all. So they came in numbers, in frustration, and they clashed with the police at night. Some of them attacked some establishments, some businesses, set them on fire. There was a lot of looting, a lot of violent clashes with the security forces.
Hundreds of Tunisians marched in the capital on Saturday to protest against police brutality they say are endangering freedoms won in the 2011 revolution that swept away an authoritarian regime. How do you explain the harsh reaction from the Tunisian police?
These protests in the capital, Tunis, usually they do take a political color. They were organized by certain political parties or groups. They were even, some of them even were led by what we saw, at least some members of parliament who joined these protesters initially as a reaction to the brutal force that was exercised against these young Tunisians who were protesting in other cities. However, I mean, the protests that we saw also had another dimensions to it, which is many of these political players were trying to prevent and stop the process of reshuffle of the government that was taking place that same day in parliament. And so we saw the reaction from the security forces was almost closed down the outskirts of the parliament, prevented these protesters from reaching some of the doors, allowed them to protest, but at the same time they did clash with them, and there was some scenes that were not used to it in the new Tunisia, let's say.
Prime Minister Shamlim Shishi announced a cabinet reshuffle to create a more effective reform team. However, Tunisian president said he would reject it. Could that lead to a constitutional crisis in Tunisia?
I believe so. I think we are inching and moving now that the reshuffle took place, now that the parliament has accepted the changes in government. I think it was like 7 or 8 new ministers were put in place with a very wide margin, I might say. But the president is not going along with this change. He thinks he has to have a say in this government since he was the one that asked Mishishi to form this government, thinking that it's going to be almost loyal to him. But Mishishi has shifted halfway through, or at least at the first couple of weeks, halfway through putting his government together. He shifted and started putting together political parties, blocks to support his new government. And so the Speaker of the Parliament, Mr. Rashid Ghannouchi, announced yesterday that the president did reject allowing these ministers to come in front of him and they swear them in as the tradition according to the Tunisian constitution. So the president is refusing that step. And this is where the constitutional crisis might take place, as the president thinks that this step is not just a protocol, is not just a technicality. But if he does it, if he accepts the nomination of these ministers, that means he's supporting them. And the head of the parliament said he disagrees with the president. He thinks that the president does not have any say in the reshuffle of the government. And so it's a matter of how do you interpret some of these sections in the constitution. And only the days to come, we'll see how both sides will react.
That was Mongi Dahoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Former presidential candidate Bobi Wine has filed a petition with Uganda's Supreme Court seeking to overturn his election loss to President Yoweri Museveni. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
In the petition, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, a.k.a. musician Bobi Wine, contends that the 14th January voting did not comply with electoral law, with irregularities substantially affecting the results. Medad Lubega Segona is one of Bobi Wine's lawyers.
The brutalization of our supporters, coordinators and campaign team, above all the brutalization of our candidate. You must have been following and watching videos across the country where soldiers would come and invade polling stations, where they would come with pre-ticked ballots and then stuff into the box. You must have witnessed the inflation of the register. You saw how Museveni's votes were inflated. You saw how the entire electoral process turned into a war situation, a situation of terror.
Segona says Bobi Wine wants the court to order fresh elections.
The voters did their work, they spoke. The Electoral Commission facilitated one man to cheat against the voters' will. We are here to allow court to do its work. The respondents, stroke suspects, are the perennial suspect, Yoweri Tibuhaburwa Museveni Yeseri Kaguta. The other one is the usual suspect, the statutory suspect, Electoral Commission. And the third is the Attorney General of Uganda.
Kyagulanyi has lined up more than 20 lawyers to handle the petition, including Anthony Wameri.
The lawyers are on board and more are coming. Some are going to be on the forefront, some are going to be in the background. But as of now, we have about 25 lawyers. Local, but we also expect some lawyers from the UK, some lawyers from Kenya, and some lawyers from the US. We are going to have witnesses from outside Uganda. We're going to have experts of different fields, especially statisticians and IT experts.
The ruling National Resistance Movement, NRM Party, says it has enough proof to defend Museveni's victory. Justin Kasule Lumumba is the NRM Party spokesperson.
As a party, we have all our declaration forms from all of the polling stations. We have them ready. We have our declaration form for the presidential from the National Electoral Commission. We have our lawyers going through the declaration forms. And when we are served, we shall respond.
Official results have Museveni getting 6,042,898 votes, 58.38%, to 3,631,437 votes, 35%, for Bobi Wine. This is the fourth time that an election victory by Museveni has been challenged in court after 2001, 2006, and 2016. All the three times, the Supreme Court dismissed the challenges, citing insufficient evidence. Museveni has ruled Uganda since 1986. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The Norwegian Refugee Council says aid organizations have been unable to reach the central and western parts of Ethiopia's Tigray region, and two refugee camps are still completely inaccessible 12 weeks after the start of conflict there. According to the NRC, Secretary General Ian Eglen says aid is getting through, but only to areas with little conflict. He warns that millions of women, children and men in the Tigray region are in a truly desperate situation, suffering alone without aid or protection. Eglen strongly urges the Ethiopian government to do whatever it takes to enable unrestricted and unconditional access to those most in need. Public health experts in Zimbabwe say the extension of a lockdown that includes a 12-hour dusk-to-dawn curfew to thwart a recent swell in COVID-19 will not yield much without upgrades to the country's health care system. The coronavirus has infected nearly 33,000, and two-thirds of its 1,178 deaths are from January alone, according to official figures. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the lockdown extension comes as the country says it is struggling to detect new, highly contagious, and probably more lethal variants of coronavirus.
Calvin Fambira is the executive director of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights, said his organization welcomed the two-week extension of the lockdown and a 12-hour dusk-to-dawn curfew by President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government.
It was going to be logical to relax measures considering the background of increased daily mortality and incidence rates of COVID-19 as compared to the pre-January levels. However, we think that there's need to complement the lockdown with, one, expanding testing, case surveillance and isolation of confirmed cases. Secondly, there's need for expansion of health sector capacity to respond to severe disease of COVID-19 in order to minimize mortality. And thirdly, there's need for a clear and accelerated approach to nationwide vaccination.
Announcing the lockdown extension late Friday, Acting President Constantino Chiwenga said the government was concerned by recent spikes in infections and coronavirus-related deaths in Zimbabwe. Official records show that more than 52% of the country's coronavirus infections are from January alone, while the rest are from last year when the country had its first incident in March. Chiwenga summed up the situation as clearly worrisome in an address on national television.
We have a likelihood of a new strains and variants circulating. These strains are more transmissible and infectious. It is in light of this that His Excellency the President of the Republic of Zimbabwe, Comrade Emmerson Dambudzo Mnangagwa, has decided to extend the level 4 national lockdown by another 2 weeks to the 15th of February 2021. The President fully appreciates the difficulties which come with this extension. Livelihoods are being disrupted, yet we must save lives and our nation.
Those most affected by the extension of the lockdown are informal traders who constitute the country's largest sector of employment. Most of them, like Brian Mutera, say they have yet to receive government assistance promised last March, unlike the situation in other countries worldwide. Consequently, he hangs around these shops selling vegetables despite government calls for him to stay at home.
During this lockdown, everyone is not wanted in town, and we do hand-to-mouth living. And it's unfortunate. In this third world country we are in, Zimbabwe, it's unfortunate because there is death and life. I'm here, I'm dicing with death, but I cannot be home. I've got two children to look after, and I have to come to the shops. In developed world, government are paying. The situation of our economy, everybody knows, it's unfortunate, and we just pray to the Lord that is going to, we have to get a vaccine or something spread over Southern Africa.
On Friday, Chiwenga, who doubles as Zimbabwe's health minister, said the country was in the process of acquiring coronavirus vaccine. A health official earlier this week told a parliamentary committee that China and Russia were among countries that had offered to supply Zimbabwe with the vaccine. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Iyabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.